Don't let the past steal your present. Taylor Caldwell.
I think it's a really great opportunity just to kind of hear stories about different places that people have been. And, you know, as a result, you hear people say all the time, like, you know, 7 months ago, I was in my apartment and I never even heard of any of this before. And like you said, like they saw it in a publication somewhere, or they picked up a magazine at the grocery store, or they just did some, you know, thoughtless thing, you know, that all of a sudden put this bug in their ear. And it's like, it does, it just sits there. And then, you know, by the time they get out there, they spend a couple weeks planning, and then 3 or 4 months later, they're coming through New Hampshire and they're, you know, talking to some dude out on the sidewalk.
I'm Doc, and this is the John Freakin' Muir Pod.
Welcome to the John Freakin' Muir Pod. Lace up those boots and sling on the pack for a romp through trails, short and long. With your host and Renaissance man, Doc, it's time to embrace the suck.
Welcome back to another week on the Trail Dirtbags and Hiker Trash. I'm Doc, and this is the John Freakin' Muir Pod. Let's start off with a reminder. If you are enjoying the podcast, take just a minute, help us out, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you're not enjoying the pod, well, just go ahead and keep that to yourself. All right. This week, I am talking to a peak bagger out of the American Northeast who's got some stories to share. Welcome to the John Freakin' Muir Pod, Phil Perry. How's it going, Phil?
It's going. Actually, I just got back in town. I was just in New England for the last, I went up on Monday. So I was up there for three full days. And I hit a couple peaks while I was up there. Actually, I hit Washington in January. That was pretty gnarly. So I literally just walked in the door like an hour ago. It was fantastic. Awful driving back.
Fantastic. And where are you located right now? Where are you calling in from?
Pennsylvania. Yeah, right outside of Harrisburg, actually.
Okay. All right. Now, I know the American Long Trail, the American Thru Hiker, has a tradition of handing out trail names on the trail. And we typically go by trail names here on the podcast, but does that go for peak bagging as well? Have you picked up a nickname, a trail name out there?
I don't think so. You know, it's not something that has ever come up. Now, that's not to say, you know, that it's not a thing, but it has not been for me. So, no, short answer. I don't have one.
Okay. Then today you are Phil. You are Phil.
I am Phil in all realms.
Very good. Hey, Phil, have you had a chance to listen to the podcast before?
I have.
Okay. So you kind of know what you're getting yourself into here.
Right.
Yeah. So you know that towards the end of the episode, we've got a segment called the Pro Tip Insight of the Week. That's where I will turn to you and ask you to share some wisdom with our listeners to make their next outdoor experience even better. So don't be surprised.
Yeah, absolutely.
You got something in mind already?
A pro tip? You know what?
Don't, actually, don't give it away. Don't give it away. I just want to know if you're ready for it.
I'm ready. We'll do it. We'll wrap it up at the end. I got a couple pro tips.
Okay. All right. Perfect. All right.
The Must Bring Gear Review.
Hey, Phil, another feature we've been doing is the Must Bring Gear Review, sponsored by the ultralight backpacking gear company Six Moon Designs. And here's how it works. If you were to let a stranger pack your bag with pretty much generic gear for a multi-day adventure, what is the one specific piece of gear you would insist on being packed? And if you've got a particular brand for that specific piece of gear, even better. So, Phil, what is your must-bring piece of gear when you're out there peak bagging?
Ooh, you know what? So, when you're doing the peaks, I would say that it's less about, I mean, you do find yourself sort of in overnight situations. Like I definitely go on multiple day, you know, I would say that two nights really would probably be the extent of like a point to point traverse. I personally try to do them in about a day. But if I had to have somebody put something in my bag, it would be complete knockoff one piece of tarpaulin. If you got to spend the night out and sleep on the ground, I'll sleep on the ground like a cowboy, but I'm not about carrying tents in those types of situations. But if you have one nice piece of water repellent fabric, bring a tarpaulin. I would 100% say a bright blue piece of tarp.
Okay. Now you know, being a peak bagger, you spend a lot of time above, you know, at elevation, correct?
Yeah.
And with the overnights there, you don't feel the need to be in a tent or a sleeping bag or?
No. Well, I mean, in my experience, for the most part, really specifically in New England, they don't really encourage you to spend much time above tree line. In fact, depending where you are, I know that in New Hampshire, I don't think that you're even actually allowed. People do it, but it's not really a situation that you should ever actually be in. There's plenty, especially in New Hampshire, the Appalachian Mountain Club, who's wonderful, they provide campsites pretty much, I would say, every couple miles. You should never really be in an overnight scenario, which you should always actually be prepared for, where you would actually have to sleep above tree line. So, I mean, that type of exposure is just kind of unnecessary. So, no.
Okay, got it. Hey, let's continue talking about gear.
It's the hiking poll.
With the hiking poll. This is a 7-question survey. It's poll, spelled P-O-L-L, like survey, not like the kind you hold in your hands out there when you're hiking.
Yeah, right.
This is a 7-question survey. It's going to help me give you a score on the sanity scale between 1 and 100. If you get a score of 1, you're completely insane. If you get a score of 100, you're completely sane. So far on the podcast, No one has gotten a completely sane score of 100. You think you're?
No,
gonna be
I don't
first?
Think anybody should.
That's right. So you're not going to get 100. Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't think so.
No. If I were to ask your daughter, you know, where does dad fall on the scale from 1 to 100? What would she say?
I'm hoping she'd give me like a 30 or 35.
Okay. Shooting low.
Yeah.
And if I were to ask your ex-wife, what score would she give you?
We wouldn't ask her anyway.
Okay. All right. We'll just leave her out.
You know, we're just going to leave her out of that.
So 7 questions, and these are related to hiking. Have you done much hiking, Phil?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right. So these should fit right in then. So first question, easy question, trekking poles or no trekking poles?
Oh, trekking poles for sure. And you know what? I'm going to qualify that because I used to be a no trekking pole guy, and and I'll tell you why I carry them. Honestly, it's the descent. I don't see any other reason to use trekking poles other than 2 reasons. Number one, they keep my hands elevated. My hands get swollen. I can feel my rings get real tight when I've had them down around like my waist after a few hours. And 2, when you're on your descent, especially when you're in that granite, those granite staircases up north, and you're coming down from 4,500 feet, it is awful on your knees. I just think they take so much pressure off of your lower body. Yeah, I'm a trekking pole guy all the way for sure.
Okay.
Or 1. You can always carry 1.
True, true. Now, with the you talked about your fingers. We call those sausage fingers. When you
sometimes you get down to the trailhead and it literally feels like you need to like cut your rings off your face. I don't know how many people wear rings while they're hiking. Maybe I'm the only one that does that, but I feel like I need to saw them off.
Yeah. How many rings do you have?
Just 2.
One on each hand?
No. One on each pinky.
On the pinkies. All right. That's how we know you're a wild man.
I'm cool.
That's a point deduction. So, I mean, you're getting closer to that score in the 30s. That's nice. Okay.
Right.
Question number 2. What's on the feet, boots or trail runners?
That's kind of loaded. That's a loaded question too, because it really kind of depends on the trail conditions. I really like my feet to be dry. I think that boots are major false support. Like, I mean, one of their big selling points is that you have just kind of that like support around your ankles, but I really just don't think it really makes that much of a difference. And they're kind of like clodhoppers to be walking around. But, you know, just for instance, this weekend, I would not have worn trail runners up into the Alpine zone. So, you know, winter hiking, definitely boots, but I wear those same boots to shovel snow. So, I mean, there's not really anything particularly special about those, but trail runners I have on the majority of the time, for sure.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite brand of trail runners?
Well, you know, I used to wear Ultras, and I still kind of do, but they do this really weird thing where the sole actually moves underneath your foot. I think what happened is they got real in love with these wide toe boxes, which is like their big selling point. And like every time they release like a new version of the Lone Peak, which are the ones that I wear, it becomes more like a clown shoe. And it might just be me because my feet are short and wide and they fit well if I'm running or if it's not a real technical situation, but they just don't work if you're really going uphill. So I wear Hokas, which I always used to make fun of because I would see girls wearing them and it looks like they have rocking chair legs on their feet because they just have this weird shape. Like, you remember those Skechers back in the day that they had that were supposed to tone like your lower legs and like your, you know, like your ass, and you wear them around all day.
That's right.
What they look like.
You didn't have to exercise. Just wear those shoes.
Right. And you just walk around in these things. Yeah, they're like magic.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, I put a pair of Hokas on and I don't think I'll ever go back. They're amazing. And they fit right, which I think is the big thing. You know, people like to talk about brands and that kind of thing. And, you know, I think that branding, I guess, is kind of important, but everybody's foot is different. So I think that that plays a lot into it, really. But yeah, Hoka's all day for sure. If I could wear trail runners in like negative degree wind chill, I would. I would definitely do it. I wouldn't advise it, but I would if I could.
Now, Phil, you need to look on the side of the Ultra boxes for the short and wide stamp.
Yeah, no, I understand, but I've been dealing with that for my entire life. Like, it's just, I have hobbit feet, like, literally. they just don't make a shoe for that.
You know, hobbit feet, clown shoes. We may come up with a trail name for you tonight, but I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
we're on the lookout, so be careful.
Yeah, right.
All right. Hey, question number three, when you do have to do an overnight out there, I think I already know the answer to this, but we're going to ask it anyway. When you do have to do an overnight out there, do you prefer a tent, tarp, hammock, bivy, or cowboy camping?
I just sleep right on the ground like a cowboy. Now, you know, I do check the summit forecasts, depending where I'm hiking. But, you know, if it's supposed to be nice out, I carry a sleeping bag and that's about it.
Okay, which goes to the next question. Sleeping bag or quilt?
Sleeping bag.
What kind do you have?
I have a Marmot Four Seasons sleeping bag.
Okay. Is it down or synthetic? Do you prefer?
It's synthetic. I think that, you know what? I don't think I've ever had a down sleeping bag now that I think about it. So I can't really speak to that preference one way or the other. I think that honestly, when I bought that one, I wanted a Four Seasons sleeping bag that I could kind of just throw one in like my Tupperware bin that I throw into the back of my car. And like the price point was good and the specs were good. And that was just the one that I bought. And I've had it a while. So, I mean, that speaks to the brand, I guess, because I use it a lot.
Yeah. Is that one of those Tupperware bins that goes in your fridge?
Yeah. No, it's one of those Tupperware bins that like you buy when you're moving. It's the Walmart bin.
Got it. It could also hold a lot of mashed potatoes if you had to.
Yeah, it could. The gear bin I call it. I have two of them. Bin. So I can just like, I'm ready to boogie anytime.
Got it. I want to go back to the boots or trail runners question again, because I had a thought, which I lost promptly as we took that your answer took so many left and right turns along the way. But
I have trouble staying on track.
Yeah, that's good. That's the best interview. So you had mentioned that, you know, they're supposed to support your boots are supposed to support your ankle, but you're not sure if that is actually true or not. And I think they've done some studies. I've heard they have done some studies to compare injuries, ankle injuries.
Right.
Those people who wear boots, those people that wear trail runners, and there is no appreciable difference in the number of injuries.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah, it's true. That's true.
Yeah. So, I mean, that makes sense. I just don't think that, you know, I would encourage anybody to try on shoes. If they like boots, wear them. But I just feel like they're clodhoppers. It's like walking around with cinder blocks. And I just think that things have progressed so much in, you know, just shoe technology that there's just no reason to be wearing these things around. And like I said, if it's cold, I guess, or if it's wet or it's icy, you know, you don't want wet feet when it's cold outside. So like a Gore-Tex shoe or something, but you know, trail runners dry out really fast too. Really, now that I think about it, I mean, you can kind of just walk right through just about anything. And if you have the right socks on, I just don't really see that there's any kind of difference between the two. And I think that a trail runner is just easier to wear. It's more like a sneaker. You wear it around at home. I just feel like as far as feet go, it's one of the most important parts of your body, obviously, when you're out hiking. So I would want to be as comfortable as possible.
Got to keep the feet happy. There's also a saying in the backpacking world that for every pound on your foot is like carrying an extra five on your back. So you're talking about
wearing
clodhoppers. I mean, that's an extra burden.
Right. And I feel like a lot of the injuries are caused just because you're moving your feet in such an unnatural way because you have boots on. You know, just the contact you make with your feet on the ground in other parts than the bottom of your foot. You know, it's like you're always just like catching the end of the boot or whatever. And it's just because it's so big and cumbersome. I just don't think they're beneficial in any kind of way. Like, it's not 1970 anymore. Like, I just don't think there's any reason that you need to be going around in a pair of caterpillars, like, you know, stomping around in the woods. It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. And with you being in Pennsylvania, also known as Rocksylvania, I believe.
For sure.
You do.
And I live on that side too.
Do you kick a lot of rocks out there?
Yeah, there is. And I'm, and it, really, I know a lot of the thru hikers. So where I live in Pennsylvania, you know, I split my time between New Hampshire and here now, but here where I grew up, it's actually, I don't know, about 30 minutes from the actual, 45 minutes from the actual halfway point on the Appalachian Trail, which is down in Pine Grove Furnace. And you know, I'm anywhere from 10 to 15 minutes away from the AT, just about anywhere. I mean, Duncannon is, I don't know, maybe 12 miles away where they actually cross the Susquehanna River. And once you're on this side of the river is really kind of where it becomes what they call Rocksylvania. And it is brutal on shoes for sure. No doubt about it. I think it's just the consistency of the rock is different. It's more of like I don't know what they call it. It's organic in a way, I guess. It's like razors, really. It's like schist and shale, you know, and you could just really shred up the bottom of any kind of, you know, I think it transcends brand or make. You're walking literally through glass is almost what it's like.
Yep. It's called Pennsylvania. There you go.
Yeah. Our ridge lines are rough.
Yeah. All right. Hey, when it comes to food out there on the trail, are you a stove guy, cold soak, or do you go stoveless?
No stove. I think if you can rehydrate anything and eat it cold, do it.
A cold soaker. Phil, that's a huge point deduction. I mean, you might be in the 20s right now.
Hey, come on. I just think that, you know, why? Look, here's the thing is it's up to you because you got to carry it, you know, so to each their own. But I mean, for me, it's what can I fit in the smallest bag possible and go. And I just don't see any reason to be carrying around fuel and, you know, rocket stoves and whatever other contraptions. I see people using all kinds of different stuff out there. And it's just like, you know, you're wasting all this time, you know, learning how to use this thing and figuring it out. And it's like, there's always somebody playing around with it and it's not working correctly. And then they're carrying all the components for it. And it's like, you can go to the Dollar General and get a piece of Tupperware that you can literally jam ramen noodles into and dump water on, and you're ready to go. And you're done before everybody else. I mean, they're still playing around making tea and all kinds of other stuff. I don't enjoy that aspect of it. I think it's, you know, I don't want to call it stupid because I know a lot of people enjoy it, but, you know, I don't want to seem biased or like, you know, rain on anybody's hiking experience, but I just don't think that there is any reason that you can't just dump water in a container and eat.
All right. Cold night. You don't need a hot meal. You can just cold soak. Okay. All right. It gives us a little insight into your state of mind. I appreciate that.
Right.
Question number 6, is life better above or below the tree line? What does a peak bagger say about this?
Oh, it's above. And anybody that says that it's not has never been above the tree line.
Good answer. No point.
I mean, point blank, that's all there is to it. And if you can't remember the first time that you broke a tree line, you know, I mean, you're lying if you say you don't. I mean, there's nothing... I don't, there's only a few things I think in life that are comparable to like that first time that you get above the trees and you're actually exposed like that. And you can just, you know, it's one of those things that there's just no verbiage for it, I guess. There's just no way to actually articulate something like that. Yeah, it's above. And if your answer is below, you've never been above the tree line.
All right. And question number 7, what's more important, pack weight or luxury items?
Pack weight. for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, I don't even really know what you mean by luxury items or what I mean. Luxury items to some people are, you know, I think that's just kind of like a matter of perspective. Some people consider some things to be a luxury. I don't know. If I don't need it, I don't carry it.
All right. So I have to do some math here, Phil. I got to put you through your answers through the John Freaking Muir algorithm. So
all right.
I do some math. I got to carry
I'm excited for this, actually. Do we get a drum roll?
Go ahead. Drum roll. drum roll away. Carry the two. Got to divide by pi. We're going to multiply that by root 3. And we're going to adjust for the atmospheric pressure from the top of Mount Washington, which is quite a trip. And you know what? 37. 37.
Oh, okay.
I like 37. It's in the 30s and it's prime. So, I mean, that's a good number.
Is that average, I guess?
No, I don't have an, I don't have an average. Some people are, you know, they get in the 60s, 70s. I mean, they're fairly sane with some pretty simple stories, and others.
Right.
Where we are.
I'm
right
just
now.
Wondering what the curve is, you know,
the curve. Love it. All right. Hey, before we
get I'll take that 37. Right. That's because I eat cold food, isn't it?
That was a big factor. I mean, you were on track for a 50-ish kind of number until we got to the cold.
Man,
food.
Listen, if you're in your own kitchen at home, I know people that will reach in the fridge with their bare hands and eat something out of a Tupperware container, you know, and they're out carrying a stove around in the woods. That's not crazy.
Yeah, I think this episode, congratulations, Phil, you have already used the word Tupperware the most number
four
of times more times than it's ever appeared in the podcast before. So, I mean, you've set a record. That might be your trail name, Tupperware.
Listen, Tupperware and Dollar General, I could probably be sponsored by them, to be honest. Listen, and I'll tell you, Dollar General, I have a really good story about their socks, too, because people like to make an argument about the best pair of socks to wear hiking. And you know what? While we're talking about Tupperware and Dollar General, you know where I get my socks from? And I will die on this hill. I get them from the Dollar General.
Is it the Dollar General brand?
Yeah, that yellow one that they build like in the middle of nowhere. Yeah, that's where I get my socks for hiking. I swear to God.
But are the
everybody's
socks
out there wearing $30 socks? I buy them at the Dollar General.
Do the socks have Dollar General on them?
They're Dollar General brand. They're synthetic. Yeah, I'm telling you. And you know what? And I throw them away when I'm done.
You might be the general. We're talking to the general tonight.
Yeah, really. They better send me some socks.
Sponsored by.
Yeah, right. It's like NASCAR.
Dollar General. Gotta wear a big old hat and a shirt with Dollar General on it. You'd be good to
go. Yeah, right. A big old Marlboro.
Mm-hmm. All right. Hey, General, before we get too far down the trail, let's back up a little bit. We'd love to hear about your origin story. Where'd you grow up? What kinds of sports did you play as a kid? And how'd you get involved in peak bagging? What's the attraction there?
Well, so, I mean, I grew up here in central Pennsylvania, you know. And a lot of times people ask about what Pennsylvania is like, and I like to tell them it's flat, but, you know, that's not entirely true. We have a lot of hiking here. I've always been outdoors. We had a cabin when I was growing up. It was up in the Alleghenies. You know, I played baseball and stuff when I was a kid. Just as far as, like, sports went, you know, I wasn't really the athletic guy. I mean, I'm an athletic person. I didn't play a lot of organized sports, you know, as a young adult, I guess you could say. I just spent most of my time outside. I mean, when we had weekends, we were away. We were up in the mountains, and it's just always kind of been that way. So, I mean, it was always just kind of a natural progression, you know, into the hiking and then the overnight hiking. I was really involved in scouts. You know, I just, I've always been outside. I just, any opportunity that I have to be outside, that's exactly where I'm at. So, you know, and Pennsylvania is great. I mean, the Alleghenies, upstate Pennsylvania, I mean, you want to talk about rural. I mean, there's not a whole lot up there. Harrisburg, right out, which is the general area that I'm from, is kind of to the south side of the Appalachian Corridor. But once you sort of get to the other side of the Appalachian Trail, I mean, there's nothing. So it's a great state to grow up in, is just as far as, you know, really getting into just out as an outdoor enthusiast. You know, but to answer your question, you know, I didn't play a lot of sports, just always been outside.
Got any brothers or sisters?
I have a sister, but she's kind of a yuppie. She's like the opposite. She lives down in Philadelphia.
I find that so interesting that, you know, kids from the same family growing up in the same environment, and
right.
One is an outdoor enthusiast, you know, to the nth level. And the other one is, you know, city folk all the way. So it's,
right.
It's interesting.
Well, I wouldn't say that she's a city folk or anything like that. I mean, they do hiking, but they have three really small kids. So actually they do a lot of so the people that you see with those Osprey backs that have like the canopy on them and like a kid in there, they do that. And I think that really that is just a whole separate thing that I don't even know if I could do it. I've met a lot of guys who I would argue are carved right out of the rock and could do just about anything. But I'd like to see some of these guys go hiking with three kids. So because I just think it's in a whole different realm. I think that's probably tough. But they were just up in, I mean, they were up in Acadia. So, I mean, she hikes, but, you know, okay. It's not really her thing. You're not going to catch her up on top of Mount Washington.
No. And any, you know, when you're young, you don't always make the best decisions. And if you're young and you grow up outdoors, sometimes that leads to some pretty good stories. Any good childhood stories of like, oh my God, I don't know how I survived that.
Oh man. I, you know, off the top of my head, like I couldn't really think anything specifically, but I mean, we used to do some pretty harebrained stuff outside. You know, to really speak to something specifically, you'd have to give me a minute to come up with something good. But yeah, I mean, like I was a kid growing up in like the late 80s and 90s. So it's just like you could do pretty much, there's no supervision, you know, and back then it was just kind of like you just went out and did whatever you wanted to do. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of times where you would come home and be like, man, I almost died.
Yeah, I talked to a guy, Phil Tucker, who grew up in the swamps down in, I think it's Mississippi, who was, you know, he had the whole swamp as his basically his backyard, and he shot a snake with a BB gun, and he was going to skin that snake, and he got the snake up onto the board, and realized that the snake was just knocked unconscious from a ricochet.
Oh.
He didn't actually shoot it, and so this water moccasin plunged its fangs into his hand. And he had to run home with this snake hanging off his hand.
Oh, as a kid,
you know, he's like 12 years old. Yeah. And, you know, the nearest hospital is like 2 hours away. So,
right.
You know, he was convinced he was going to die. And his mom was convinced he was going to die too, but he made it. So.
No, I mean, it's worse than that. You're not going to die. You're just going to have a rough couple days, especially if you take a loaded bite. I mean, we have all they tell you to do is leave them alone. Just leave them alone. Yeah, I mean, I guess when you're a kid, there were certainly plenty of times where we were messing around with snakes. But to be honest with you, I have a fear of, I don't want to say a fear of snakes, but I'm like Indiana Jones in that regard. Like, I don't want anything to do with them. I don't mess with them. Pennsylvania is loaded with timber rattlesnakes. And when you see them, you leave them alone. I mean, you know, in fact, I do have a story about snakes. I had a dog one time. This was only a couple years ago, and I was still married at the time, and we were hiking down in White Rocks Acres, which is right outside of Boiling Springs. So anybody that's familiar with the Appalachian Trail, you come through Boiling Springs before you cut across the Cumberland Valley in Pennsylvania. And I had a lab that used to point at everything and pointed at this snake up on the ridgeline and got bit. And I don't think she took a loaded bite, but I had to carry that dog almost 2.5 miles back down to the car and then to the vet because she got bit by a rattlesnake. So, yeah, I don't mess around with those things. No way.
And she was a lab. How much did she weigh?
75, 80 pounds, maybe.
Oh, my gosh. 2.5 miles. That's
yeah, it did down. Yeah. And, you know, we don't have ridiculous elevation here in Pennsylvania, but, I mean, you know, you just don't mess around with them. I just leave them alone. I see them all the time. And I wonder sometimes because I see people hiking and, you know, they're just sticking their hands and feet everywhere. you know, and they got kids and stuff with them, and they have animals with them, and they're in places that I know are loaded with those things. I mean, you're going to have a bad day. You get bit by one. I mean, you're not going to die, but you're going to have a rough time.
It's not going to be a whole lot of fun. Hard. No.
Ugh. That's the one thing I like about New England. You don't have to look where you're putting your hands or your feet ever.
All right. Now, how do you finance your adventures? What do you do? What do you do to pay the bills?
So I've been in the restaurant industry for almost 20 years. Back in 2021, at the beginning of the year, in January, I got out of the restaurant industry for about a year, year and a half. I'd been bartending really up until that point. And I just recently, this summer, got back in. I'm not bartending, but I am serving, you know, because it's easy. It's a no-brainer. The industry is dying for people. I mean, it's the only job in the world where you can pick up and totally relocate to another part of the country, which I did, to New Hampshire, and you can have a job within 24 hours making $350-$400 a day. And it's kind of funny that you mentioned that, because a lot of people, like, they look at Instagram and they think because I have all these followers and I'm a wealthy person and I don't work. And that's actually not the case. I do go to work, but, you know, because of what I do, I mean, I work 2 or 3 days a week, but, you know, just for quick income to be able to finance a certain type of lifestyle, you know, where I pick up and go and you're buying gear and you're traveling and you're paying for gas and you're doing that kind of thing. I mean, the restaurant industry is a no-brainer. Anybody with zero skills can go in and be and make money. I don't know why people don't want to do it. I don't think people want to work.
Yeah, and now you mentioned your Instagram account, and you mentioned bartending and being in the restaurant business, which would you mind talking about? I know from your Instagram page that you are in recovery. You are
absolutely.
And, yeah, so you know, it seems to me working in a bar, being a bartender, I mean, that would be pretty rough.
Yeah, I couldn't go back to that.
Yeah, so would you mind sharing your story of just your journey along that road?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, okay. You know, I can give you kind of the broad strokes about it. And actually, it kind of ties in a lot with, like, the hiking and that type of thing now. And it's actually something that I talk to people pretty frequently. A lot of times I run into people when I'm hiking, actually more often than I thought that I would, that are sober hikers. I mean, it's big. And, you know, just to go back to January of 2021, I had a really rough time during the pandemic where I just mentally was absolutely exhausted. And you just, you know, after almost 2 decades of just being evicted and having cars repossessed and getting DUIs and being in jail and just being absolutely mentally and physically exhausted of, you know, just, I mean, I'm an alcoholic. I don't know how to drink, and it permeates and ruins every part of my life. And I got out of that cycle, and I had my last drink on January 4th of 2021. And, you know, yeah, I couldn't go back in the restaurant industry. But speaking to that, and also speaking to hiking, there's a really interesting parallel. And I think because I have such a large sober community that I engage with because of Instagram, and also outside of Instagram, they gravitate towards the outdoors. And, you know, that's something that I really spent a lot of time thinking about. You know, I think part of it is just a change of scenery, and part of it is just people doing things that they've never done before. But also, when I really thought about it a little bit more in depth, like, all of the things that I like about hiking, about gear, are skill sets that people in recovery already have, because you've spent years, you know, being totally self-reliant, totally resourceful, trying to get high every day, trying to get drunk every day, trying to pay bills, trying to do all of these different things while also maintaining a relationship with alcohol and substance abuse. You already have this skill set that is totally applicable to being able to, you know, be out in the backcountry and rely on yourself. So there's, like, this parallel between the two. And I think that it's why it's so attractive to me to have gotten back into it. And also why it's so attractive to other people that are new into recovery that maybe weren't into that type of thing before, because it's now, how far can I push myself physically? How far can I push myself mentally? Like, how much can I know about gear and how reliant on, you know, It's just this self-reliance, like, and it's totally just this resilience that I think that people develop over years and years and years of just totally abusing their bodies for all of the wrong reasons, that they then take it over into something that they can channel into that is more positive, physically positive, mentally positive. So, you know, yeah, I mean, I am sober, and I run, the sober hiking community is huge. I mean, there are a ton of us out there, and you run into them all the time. So, yeah.
Hey, I want to congratulate you on 2 years of sobriety. That just came up, right? So nice job.
Yeah, 2 years. Yep.
Yep. Now, when you decided to get sober, I mean, had you hit rock bottom? Was January 4th a particularly bad day, or January 3rd a particularly bad day? Or
yeah, well, I mean, I've been thinking about it for a while up until that point. I mean, I've been in and out of treatment. If I think about it, you know, close to, well, in recent history, twice, but in my 20s, I was in and out of detox and treatment several times. I mean, that was a rough decade, but, you know, I think because as a result of the pandemic, there was just a lot of, nothing was open. There was nowhere to go. There was nothing to do. And if people weren't spending time outside, but I just think that people that really have a problem with alcohol and substance abuse really went through it, just being stuck at home. Mm-hmm. You know, depending on the type of programs that they were working, I think a lot of people went through relapses and that type of thing. Like, it was rough. It was just a really rough time. I had enough. It's really what it boils down to. Like, I would have rather put a gun in my mouth than taking another drink is really what it came down to. And I mean, and I really thought about it for a couple of weeks up to that point. And I had a really good recovery center that kind of kept in contact with me and was like, hey, you know, maybe today's the day, like, we have a bed. Like, if you're thinking about it, like, you can come in. And it didn't take a whole lot before I was like, you know what, I think it's time. I'm convinced, honestly, that if I would have continued on that trajectory, we wouldn't be having this conversation today, I don't think. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's hard to say. I'd be in rough shape if we were.
All right. Well, congratulations on 2 years of sobriety again. That is impressive. I'm glad it's going well. And we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and hear about some of your adventures peak bagging. We're going to talk about New England and the Adirondacks and New Hampshire. And hear from our sponsors here. And we'll be right back. Stay tuned.
From the backcountry to the backyard, we believe everyone deserves the highest level of protection. Since 1984, Sawyer Products offers the best, most technologically advanced solutions for protection against sun, bugs, and water, using time-released liposome technology, topical insect repellents, and new standards in water filtration. And with every Sawyer product you buy, you are helping to provide clean water through 140 charities in 80 countries with their long-lasting water filters. Every Sawyer product you buy is an investment in our common humanity. Choose Sawyer and keep the adventure going, knowing that their products have been tested and chosen by those who count on serious protection on the trail all day long. Six Moon Designs has been innovating ultralight backpacking gear for the past 20 years. With a wide range of products ranging from ultralight shelters to backpacks and accessories like their extensive line of trekking umbrellas, Six Moon Designs is sure to have a great piece of gear for your needs. With the company philosophy being that gear should aid one's experience, not define it, Six Moon Designs thinks the more time people spend outside the natural world, the better off this world will be. And remember, go wild, live young. This episode is sponsored by Jolly Gear. Are you tired of compromising between the ventilation of a button-down and the full protection of a sun hoodie? With the Triple Crown button-down, you can have the best of both. Plus, their fun standout patterns will have you the talk of the trail. Visit them at jollygear.com. Through hiker owned, Jolly Gear, where fun meets functional.
And welcome back. We're talking to Phil Perry, also known maybe as the General or Tupperware. I don't know. those might stick by the end of the episode.
And yeah, I like them. They have a ring to them, I guess.
I'm really tickled about, you know, the huge big gear bin full of cold mashed potatoes out there on the trail with you.
Yeah, right. The Idahoan potatoes.
Yeah, I mean, if you carried a lab, a 75-pound lab, you know, 2.5 miles after a snake bite, I mean, it's not no big deal to carry a big bin of mashed potatoes.
Yeah, I could just rope it right on. Like, I don't even need any lumbar support. I could just wear that as a bag.
That's right. And if you eat enough and you eat fast enough, you could actually sleep under it then too.
Yeah, probably. I think that's how Sherpas do it.
Yes. All right. So, Phil, you spent a lot of time in the American Northeast bagging peaks. Now, I have here on the outline, I've got something called the New Hampshire 48, the Adirondack 46, and the New England 67.
Right.
So imagine those all refer to peaks, but for our listeners out there who may not be familiar with peak bagging in the Northeast, explain to us, what are those?
Okay, well, you know, actually, and anybody that's thru-hiked the Appalachian Trail may actually be familiar with them and not even realize that they are. But for anybody that's not familiar with the Appalachians, essentially there are groups of peaks. There are different geological formations. The Adirondacks is actually different. That's not the Appalachians, of mountains that are over 4,000 feet. And some of them are as high as, you know, 5,500. Mount Washington is 6,288. It's not the highest one on the East Coast, which a lot of people think that it is. It's considered an ultra summit and it has an exposed summit. But I don't even think it's actually in the top 10. So basically, you work your way through these lists. So, for instance, the New Hampshire 48, there are 48 peaks that are on the list, and you knock them down one at a time. And that's essentially all that it is. The New England 67 is a combination of the 48 peaks in New Hampshire, the 5 peaks in Vermont, and the 14 peaks in Maine. And then there are 46 of them over in the Adirondacks. They're the highest peaks north of the Mason-Dixon line. And there are other 4,000 foot mountains, but they have to have a very specific topographical prominence from, you know, say like a sister peak or a shoulder. It's different, I think, in the Adirondacks than it is in New England. The AMC, and somebody will probably fact check me on this, but I think there has to be a difference of 200 feet in topographical prominence between the saddle and the two peaks. I think, I'm pretty sure that's what it is. So, I mean, and you get the list and you work your way through it, and there's different combinations to do it, but essentially you're just working your way through, and that's it. I mean, that's the list. Now, people try to do them in a single season. People try to do them, you know, in the winter. People try to do each one once every month of the year, which they call a grid. So, you know, there's different combinations where you can kind of do the same hikes, different ways, different routes in the same area, and kind of, you know, you could spend a lifetime doing it, really. But that's essentially what it boils down to. And going back to the Appalachian, people who have done the Appalachian Trail, they might actually be familiar with a lot of them because you cross over some of them when you move through Vermont all the way up to Katahdin. Katahdin is on the list. Katahdin and Baxter Peak are two of the New England 67 on the 67 list, two of the peaks in Maine, where you end, and you cross over the Presidential Range on the AT, the Willie Range, Franconia, the Kinsman. I think you hit all five. You definitely hit all five of them in Vermont. And I think you hit all of them in the Mahoosics too, in Maine, when you cross from New Hampshire into Maine. New Hampshire is the only one that you don't cross over top of all of them on the Appalachian Trail, because there's 48 of them. So, but that's essentially what it is.
Phil, I just want to stop you here for a second, because for our listeners, they're not watching this on YouTube, they have no idea what they're missing here. I just have you know that Phil is not referring to any kind of resource material. He's not looking at notes. He doesn't have a computer up where he's got all this information. He is rattling all of this off of the top of his head.
Oh yeah, right. I mean, I could go at length. I could give you peaks, routes, what crosses over top of them. I mean, some of them are multiple trails. I spent a lot of time up there. I mean, I lived up there the last almost 6 months. So, I mean, as far as New Hampshire goes, there are certainly people up there that are absolute legends, and they know it better than I do. But you know, you'd be hard pressed to find too many people that are as familiar with it as some of them. But yeah, I know it well.
Yeah, you're like a peak bagging savant.
Well, maybe just in New England. I mean, don't ask me about Colorado or anything like that, because I couldn't tell you. So I don't want to put that feather in my hat.
Okay, a couple of follow-up questions, because we covered a lot of ground right there.
Yeah,
one
right.
Of the things you brought up was very interesting, is that Mount Washington's only, what, 6,200? Did you say 6,200?
Yeah, 6,288.
Yeah, and so for us people here on the West Coast who are close to the Sierras and the Pacific Crest Trail, I mean, 6,200 feet does not sound
like Let's do this. We'll have this conversation. Go ahead.
So my question is, I know that some of the top wind speeds and some of the coldest temperatures are recorded at Mount Washington.
And so the highest, period.
I stand corrected. Savant, you may correct me. But for anybody here on the West Coast who's thinking, you know, 6,200 feet, come on. That's
right. Yeah, I know. I hear it all the time.
I mean, just knowing what I know about Mount Washington and the temperatures recorded there, I mean, it's pretty extreme.
Right. Well, and listen, and here's the thing. And look, this is like it's an age old debate between people out West with their 14ers and people that live in New England and, you know, what's tougher. And I'm going to tell you, hands down, if you can hike in New England, if you can do the elevation gains, if you can do, you know, just the exposure up there, if you can do the weather up there, you can hike anywhere in this hemisphere, full stop. You know, and I get it. Like, you guys have some big peaks up there, you know, out West. I mean, Wyoming and Colorado and, you know, even out in California. You know, you don't have to explain that to me. You don't. But I've met some of the toughest hikers in America in New England, hands down. I would be hard pressed to find hiking that is comparable anywhere else, probably on the continent. And I mean, you can ask people that have been everywhere. I mean, the conditions are worse. It's, you know, we can go down through a checklist of things that you want to debate, East Coast versus West Coast, if you want to. But
hey, I'm not spoiling for a fight. I agree with you. I say that, you know what, Mount Washington, it's a record holder. I mean, how can you argue?
It is. It's tough.
Yeah,
it's gnarly up there. I mean, listen, I was up there 2 days ago in the summit forecast. I mean, they said, you know, 45, 50 mile per hour sustained winds, which is pretty typical for up there. You know, but the gusts had to be, you know, it could be 70, 75 miles per hour. I mean, it's insane. It's a total whiteout. The weather, they have a saying up in the White Mountains, if you don't like the weather, wait 15 minutes. What happens is you have a couple different weather patterns that move across the United States, basically unobstructed, United States and Canada, because there's nothing in the interior of the United States. And these weather patterns smack into the White Mountains. And it's like the first barrier that they have for thousands of miles. And the nexus to that is kind of like the presidential range, which is the range that Mount Washington is in. So it creates this just kind of like recipe for some really disastrous weather sometimes. I was up on Franconia, actually, in Franconia Ridge, which is where Lafayette is. And again, anybody that's hiked the Appalachian, you crossed over Lafayette, you know, in New Hampshire. It's the highest mountain outside of the presidential range. It's close to 5,200 feet. It might be a little bit more than that. And this was in the end of July, and I walked through a snow squall at elevation, and it's, I don't know, 40 degrees, 45 degrees where you're walking. The snow is not accumulating, but it's snowing in July. So we get kind of the same weather that you definitely get it over on the West Coast with much higher elevations. You know, so it's kind of just this like mini version of like really big mountains, like that people think of when they're thinking of big mountains. And, you know, it's not something that people think about. It's actually, I think it takes a lot of people by surprise just because the White Mountains are somewhat accessible. I want to say there are some very easy, or I would say very short day hikes that you can do to get to some pretty unreasonable altitude that anybody can drive up from like Boston or New York or wherever, you know, and they're used to hiking rail trails, you know, on the weekends. And now all of a sudden they find themselves in a situation where there's like ice in, you know, the end of June. So it does. I mean, it offers some pretty wild weather. Mount Washington, especially. I mean, I post videos about it all the time. I mean, I have some pretty gnarly videos of just being up there. So yeah, it is. It can be. It's rough. It's tough hiking.
Now you said you were just up there a few days ago or a few weeks ago?
Just the day before yesterday.
And how were the conditions?
I mean, it was like 50 mile an hour sustained winds. I mean, the gusts were probably over 70. You know, I don't know what the wind chill was. I mean, it had to be down around 10 degrees or less. I mean, it was cold. Mm-hmm. The thing about up there, though, is that, you know, you hike it in the summer and, you know, you can kind of see where you're going. It's a lot of like ice fields, that kind of thing. The rime ice builds up. When the condensation, the humidity actually raises a little bit and you get condensation and it looks like snow, but it's just ice. I mean, it's literally like, I tell people it's like Hoth. I don't know if anybody's a Star Wars fan, but it's like Return of, or The Empire Strikes Back at the beginning when they're just on the ice planet. I mean, that's what it looks like. It looks like a totally different planet. It was cold up there. I only passed two other hikers. I only passed two other hikers and I was maybe on the summit 10 minutes before I was like, I got a boogie.
Nice. Now let's go back to the New Hampshire 48, the Adirondack 46, New England 67. Some people, I mean, you went through a lot of time spans. You know, some people try and hike it in a season. Sometimes they try and do all of them each month, called gritting. You know, what is your time frame? I imagine some people even try and do this, you know, this is a lifetime goal. They want to hike all 48 or all 67. But what is your time frame?
Well, I mean, I did the Vermont 5 in a week. That was actually pretty pedestrian. You know, the only one that I thought was really tough was Mansfield. Now it's only because it was the highest one in Vermont, but you know, they were pretty easy day hikes. New Hampshire took me a while, although for a lot of that, I was commuting from Pennsylvania before I actually lived up there. I did that in less than a year, you know, and I mean, there's people up there that do it in, you know, they want to do it in one winter season. So they do it in less than 3 months. You know, there's some that you can kind of string together, and then there's some that it's like you just got to kind of go for it, and it's a 17-mile day if you just want to get one, and all it is a pile of rocks at the top that denotes the summit. So some of them you have to put a little bit of time and effort to actually grab all of them, so that could take a while. Maine, I haven't finished. I've done some hiking in the Mahoosics, but I always kind of had this idea in my head that I would do Katahdin last for the New England 67. But like, I always have this idea with the Appalachian Trail on the back burner. And, you know, every year it comes up. And then every year I spend a couple weeks thinking about it. And then every year it's like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to put that kind of time together to be able to actually do it. So, you know, Katahdin has always just kind of been like, I don't really want to touch it yet because I'm not really sure where I'm kind of going with, you know, some other ideas. So I might not actually finish it. Like, I think I'm going to finish doing all of them in Maine with the exception of going that far north. And I'm just going to kind of leave that because I know in my head that at some point I'm just going to pull the trigger and just do the whole 2,200 miles and just kind of say, fuck it, let's do it. You know, and I kind of just want to leave that alone up there. You know, like, I don't want it to be touched. I don't want to do it two times. I feel like I could just wrap everything up and just hit that one time, and it'll be more special to me than if I just kind of climb up there to finish 67 peaks. Like, you know, I don't know. I just don't think this it's as celebratory. So I'm kind of thinking I'm going to leave that one alone.
Bill, I got some news for you. You know, I've talked to a lot of thru-hikers on this podcast, a lot of people who have walked a lot of miles. And right. We talk about, you know, what, you know, how did they end up on the trail? How did they end up being a thru-hiker? Someone who wanted to hike 2,200 miles or 2,600 miles. And, you know, it always starts with an idea. You know, they heard about the trail. They're familiar with the trail. Right. They read a book or saw a movie about the trail. And it just kind of festers. It festers in their mind for years. Sometimes it's a year and a half. Sometimes it's right. You know, I've talked to people that it was 15, 20 years. And they just can't get away from it. They always return to it in their mind. They're thinking about it. And guess what? They end up doing it. At some point, it just becomes too much. And they say, I have to address this. I have to see if I can do it.
And it just kind of looms over top of everything. Because, like, I'm even now talking about, like, I could complete this list that I've been working on for a while. But I kind of don't want to because it's also the northern terminus of the Appalachian Trail. And I know that at some point I'm going to do it, but I feel like the universe kind of has a way of like throwing you that opportunity when the timing is the most right. So, you know, I'm not really, you know, I couldn't really assign like a time frame to it, but it'll happen for no doubt about it. You know, and it's just like, especially when you're as an avid hiker, yeah, but you're right. You have a lot of people that are just like, screw it. I'm going to go to REI and I'm going to get this stuff and I'm going to figure it out on my way. I run into people like that all the time. You know, where I was working up in New Hampshire, people actually, when they would come down off the Kinsman and cross Route 93 to go up Liberty Springs Trail up onto Franconia, which is where the Appalachian Trail crosses over Route 93 and then goes into part of the Pemmi Loop. You see people walking by all the time. I mean, I probably saw just in the time that I was up there, I'd say 600 or 700 hikers. And those are just the ones that came into town. There was a hostel there and that kind of thing. And when you I like to go out of my way to talk to them because I think it's a really great opportunity to learn about gear. I think it's a really great opportunity just to kind of hear stories about different places that people have been. And, you know, as a result, you hear people say all the time, like, you know, 7 months ago, I was in my apartment and I never even heard of any of this before. And like you said, like they saw it in a publication somewhere or they picked up a magazine at the grocery store. Or they just did some, you know, thoughtless thing, you know, that all of a sudden put this bug in their ear, and it's like it just sits there. And then, you know, by the time they get out there, they spend a couple weeks planning, and then 3 or 4 months later they're coming through New Hampshire and they're, you know, talking to some dude out on the sidewalk, you know, about how, you know, they're almost done. I mean, when you get to New Hampshire, I mean, you're getting to one of the toughest portions of the trail, but you're also getting to that point where, like, you really, I mean, you have a long way to go, but in the grand scheme of things, you've walked, I don't know, 1900 miles at that point. So like you're getting there, like you're almost at the end. So it's like celebratory and it is, it's really cool to share with people, but you're absolutely right. It does. It gets in there and it doesn't go away. Like, I mean, you just wind up having to do it.
Yeah. And I also find with thru hikers, and I imagine with a list, like, you know, 48 peaks or 46 peaks or 67 peaks, I mean, there's a lot that goes into the planning of that. There's crossing off of things. And I have to imagine that there is a certain personality that is well suited to that. And that's an obsessive, addictive personality.
That is what it is. Yep.
You're just drawn to it and you feel the need. I mean, if you're going to complete 67 peaks, I mean, you've got to have some persistence, which involves obsessiveness. Right.
Yep, it is obsessive. Like you see it and you get addicted to it. And then you start looking at how other people are doing it. They're like, oh yeah, well, you got it all done. Now do one every month of the entire year so that you get a whole grid. And then they, you know, pull something else out of their hat where they're like, okay, now you got to do them all in a winter season. It is. It's absolutely addictive. 100%. And I mean, there is a lot of planning and that type of thing that goes into it. Like there's a lot of layers to it. Yeah, definitely.
And I think that's helpful in your situation. I mean, you have an addictive personality, right? You had a relationship with alcohol. And is this helpful, being able to devote your time and energy and your obsessiveness and channel it into this format?
Yeah, it's just like manic energy. Like, I'm the kind of guy that's just like, I think of something and I do it. I just do it. And it gives me an outlet, you know, that's something that's healthy, something that's positive. I mean, in some ways, maybe it's not like totally healthy. I don't know. But, you know, but it is definitely an outlet where you can just be like, okay, this is something where it's, you know, I'm not drinking myself to death. I can just say, I'm going to do this and then just go. Like, and I'm one of those guys. It's just like, I think of something and I do it. Mm-hmm. So, and working on those peaks is perfect for that.
Yeah. No.
Because there is a lot of logistics to it, but also it's kind of like, you can just, I've done some of them a dozen times, 13 times, you know, you just think about it. Like, I'll sometimes be sitting on my couch when I'm living up there and be eating lunch and be like, screw it, I'm going to do Lafayette today, I think. And then, you know, any normal person is like, well, but it's going to be dark soon. And I'm like, yeah, I don't care. I have a headlamp. Like, I'm just doing it. You know, and then I get great pictures of the sunset and Franconia Notch, like, it, you know, but it is, it's just like, you can channel that manic energy. And it for me, it's always helpful. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, is this typically a solo pursuit, or do you have a partner or some friends that you do this with?
I do. I mean, I have a lot of friends up there. It's difficult getting people from Pennsylvania to go up there and hike, but I mean, the hiking community up there is huge. I would say half of the people that you talk to up there preface every conversation with, well, when I did the Appalachian Trail. So it's like, you know, they hike. I mean, you run into people all the time. And when you're hiking, you know, you run into the same people over and over and over again. You know, you run into them here and there. I get people that recognize me from social media and vice versa. I'm like, oh, hey, I fuck, like, your pictures that you take pop up in my algorithm all the time. We follow each other. So yeah, there's always people to hike with if you want to. But, you know, I do a lot of kind of the solo thing. I like to just go and then not really have to worry about what somebody else is doing some of the time. I'm sure you understand that kind of in a way, mm-hmm. where, you know, sometimes hiking with other people is a pain in the ass, especially when it's like if it's the first time, like, you start connecting with people and, you know, they're like, oh, hey, I'll go. And, you know, I don't really, like, I'm never in a hurry to get anywhere necessarily, but man, like, sometimes once you're out in the back country, like, you're stuck with that person the rest of the day or longer. So, you know, that could go either way sometimes. So, you know, a lot of times I prefer to do stuff by myself.
That's right. Hey, Phil, are you familiar with the different types of fun, you know, type one fun, type two fun, etc.?
Sort of.
So type one fun is you're having fun when it happens, but you really don't talk about it a whole lot afterwards. Type two fun is you are absolutely not having fun while it's happening, but man, it is a good story that you tell over and over again.
Oh, I don't know. Can't you be both?
You could. I'm not sure which type that is, but the type two fun is like, I barely survived, but I like telling this story.
No, well, you know, I think actually that just depends on the situation, because I think there's some instances where it's where you leave and you're like, whoa, like, we're never going to talk about that again. And then there's other times where it was just a blast because everything went according to plan and you do talk about it, but afterwards. But I, you know what, sometimes you get into some sticky situations and you don't talk about it for a little while, but then, like, after a while, it's safe to talk about, like, you know, hey, you remember when we almost died? So
Do you have any of those stories you want to share?
Absolutely. Well, yeah. So 2 years ago, one of the first times that I was up in, I want to say it was 2 years ago, maybe two summers ago. Yeah, I got caught in a really, really bad storm up on top of Franconia. Actually, this happened two different times, like thunder, lightning, and I couldn't see, like, whiteout situation. And this was before I was really super familiar with the White Mountains, actually, in general. And this is a story I can think of off the top of my head. And I had actually wandered down over the back side of Franconia Ridge down into the Pemi Wilderness. And at the time, I wasn't really able to tell where I was at based on other peaks that I was looking at, because I hadn't been on top of all of them yet. So that was a little bit worrisome, but it actually worked itself out. There was another time I fell real bad, but that worked itself out too. So yeah, those are two I can think off the top of my head for sure.
Okay. Hey, what is the next big adventure for Phil?
Next big adventure. I keep saying like, I don't want to these lists, but I think this summer I'm going to spend a lot of time up in the Adirondacks. Like I want to hammer those out. I want to do the Great Range Traverse. Actually, you know, and the Catskills, a lot of people overlook that in New York because those mountains aren't that big, but there are 2,000-4,000 footers, I think, in the Catskills, but I think I'm going to work my way through some of them. And they're not ridiculous to drive over the Adirondacks from New Hampshire, depending where I'll be at for the majority of this summer. But also the Adirondacks is a quick 5.5-hour drive from Pennsylvania. So that might actually be a good fit. So I think I'm going to try to work my way through those definitely this summer. So that's something that I've been kind of like planning out a little bit logistically. The longer you're doing it, the easier maps are to read. So I was never much of a map reader before, but I think you really kind of develop a skill for actually being able to figure out what stuff looks like in real time topographically, and it makes it easier to plan stuff. So yeah, I think Lake Placid, that's the next stop.
Okay. Now I know that the Northeast is a big place, a lot of mountains, a lot of people out there doing their thing. But I'm going to ask the question anyway, because I've had a number of people on the podcast that have spent a lot of time in the Northeast and are working their way through the grid and doing a lot of peak bagging. The ones that come to mind right off the top of my head, Jason Kanosh, JM Kanosh on his social media. I don't know if you're
familiar. I don't know if I follow him or not. Is he in the Adirondacks or in New Hampshire?
Oh, he's going to get mad at me. I think he's in New Hampshire.
I'm going to have to look because that kind of rings a bell, but I don't know him personally.
Okay. He was also savant-like in his talk with me. I called him the professor because he seemed to know everything.
Jason Kanosh.
Yeah. Kinosh. JM Kanosh.
Oh, is there a little underscore in between the two?
Could be. Yes.
I think we are friends on Instagram, maybe, okay. But I do not know him personally. No.
Okay. And he's got a buddy that I interviewed him with, Mike Kucharski with a K.
That Kucharski. One I don't know.
Yeah, I think his Instagram handle is me. How are you?
No, I'm not. Because okay. The hikers, I'm pretty careful to vet when people follow me. And if they're hikers and they're doing the same things I'm doing, I always follow them back.
Yeah. And then there's another guy. I forget his full name, but I think his Instagram handle is Niels Simple Life. Niels.
That's familiar, but I don't know him personally either.
Okay. Yeah. People doing a lot of great things out there in the Northeastern United States. So,
you know, I think he's from New Hampshire, actually, now that you say that. Well, see, now I'm going to have to go through and look at some of the people that I follow.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Hey, Tupperware, you know where we are right now?
What's that? We're at the end. You're going to ask me what you're going to give me that the rundown question, the gear. Oh, the advice.
The pro tip insight of the week.
That's right, Phil. It's time for you to share some outdoor adventure wisdom with our listeners to make their next outdoor experience even better. What piece of advice do you have for them?
You know what? There's only one piece of advice that I would give anybody. Regardless of the time of the year, if you're thinking about coming up to New England to hike, and it's really simple, and it could be, you know, it's whatever your version of gear is that you carry, but be prepared to spend the night. 100%. You know, there was just a young lady a couple weeks ago that they found her up on top of Lafayette. She was away from where she thought she was going to be, according to some different sources. That were sort of there, that were in, PEMI search and rescue and that type of thing. She was a little bit underprepared. I don't like to be quick to judge what happens. We've all done things, that could have worked out in a different way or been in situations that could have been bad. So I'm not here to judge, but I would tell somebody 100% be prepared to spend the night. I mean, there's so many times where you hear about people that, you know, just from a result of exposure and just sort of a lack of understanding of the situation that they're in. They would be alive, you know, if they could have just like held on until somebody could have found them. So just prepare. Always be ready.
Tragic story. Very tragic story. There's also been a couple
of stories. And that's just the one that I can think off the top. What's that?
So there's also been a couple of tragic stories out west here. Mount Baldy, Mount San Antonio, out here in Southern California.
Mount Baldy was just today I saw on the news.
Yeah.
That guy is missing.
Yeah.
Got one missing. I think they think there's some foul play involved in that.
There was somebody else who maybe a week ago, 2 weeks ago, also fell off the top of Mount Baldy. It's icy conditions up there. We've just had storms rumble through. And if you don't have the right footwear and you take a misstep,
right,
it's tragic.
Yeah, that's it. It's curtains. And I mean, it's so easy. You're always one compound fracture away from being stuck somewhere, you know, and that can happen to anybody. It doesn't matter about skill set. It doesn't matter, you know, how much time you spent out hiking. It doesn't matter, you know, how seasoned you are. You could break your ankle, you could fall, you could do whatever. And then it comes down to like preparation. And anybody, you know, whether you've been hiking a week or 10 years, should be able to very easily come up with a rundown of stuff that they should have with them to be able to spend the night. I mean, it's a no-brainer, especially in places where the weather conditions can change like that, you know. And just like, you know, there was another guy just a couple weeks ago too that I think it was also on Lafayette that passed away up there as a result of exposure. And I'm telling you, you do not want to die from hypothermia. I think I would rather burn to death. It just does not seem like it is a good way to go, and you can prevent it. So
those both sound like bad options, Phil.
Yeah, I don't want either one of them.
Yeah. All right. So there you have it. That's it. This episode is just about in the books. Hope our listeners enjoyed our time with Phil. Want to thank him for joining us this week. Phil, how can our listeners keep up with you on social media, and where can they find updates on your latest adventures?
Well, they can follow me at Phil_Perry, Perry.
On Instagram? Just Instagram?
Yeah, that's my Instagram handle. I don't really use Facebook. I didn't really know anything about social media really until about like a year and a half ago. So, I use Facebook sometimes, but I mostly post on there so my mom knows that I'm still alive.
Good son. All right.
Right.
Remember to check out the pod on social media as well. We are on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you have any comments or clips you want to share, you can send it to me at johnfreakingmuir@gmail.com.
The Adventure Media Recommendation.
Phil, I'm also looking to you to share a recommendation for a book, a movie, documentary, website, something, some kind of outdoor adventure media to keep our listeners connected to the trail. You have any recommendations for us? We call this our adventure media recommendation.
Oh man, you know, that's kind of an on the spot question. Yeah, actually, you know what? If you really want, this is something that to really give people a taste of New England, especially if you're out west or that type of thing, I'm just going to go ahead and say you should follow the Mount Washington Observatory. It's at MWOBS. They post summit conditions. They post the weather, and they post some pretty amazing photos just about every day from the weather station on top of Mount Washington. You should follow that.
Okay, good recommendation. We'll check that one out.
What have we not asked you?
And before we wrap things up, Phil, just one more segment for you called What Have We Not Asked You That You're Dying to Tell Us About? What do we miss tonight?
I don't know. I feel like I went on at length about just about everything New England related. I mean, I could keep going talking about all the merits of hiking in New England if you'd like me to. But I mean, I could do this for probably another 24 hours. So I think we covered pretty much everything.
Well, if you have another 24 hours in you, we might have to break that up into a couple of episodes.
Yeah, we could just do a whole series. Like, I mean, you could just come up to New England and we could just broadcast live from like all 48 summits if you want to.
Perfect. Doc and Phil from the summit.
Yeah. Call it. Right. That has a ring to it. I don't know. Yeah. That might be big.
All right. Hey, that is a wrap from the John Frickinger studio. Any shout outs to friends and family, Phil?
No. they're gonna see it. I mean, I don't know. Like, they're gonna watch it. Shout out. Yeah, I guess my kids. I don't know. That's kind of a weird one. I don't really have anybody to shout out to, I guess. I don't know.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for tuning in. Always remember, the trail is the trail. It doesn't care if you want to go downhill. It doesn't care if it's almost dark and you're looking for a campsite. It doesn't even care if you had to carry your 75-pound snake bit dog back down the trail. The trail is the trail. Embrace.
Yeah, it doesn't. Thank you.